This is Charles Grodin talking to Rabbi Saul on Dave's Gone By on UNC Radio. I hope you tune in.
Shalom, everybody. This is Rabbi Saul Solomon here from Temple Sons of Bitches in Great Neck, New York, and I am so thrilled to be talking to a wonderful veteran actor of television, film, and movies, but film and movies are sort of the same thing. Let me give a rundown of this man. He was in, of course, The Heartbreak Kid, Midnight Run, the Beethoven films, Seems Like Old Times, The Great Muppet Caper, oh my god, in theater. Did you know that he was in the original Broadway cast of Same Time Next Year? He also directed the Herb Gardner play Thieves. He's written plays. He had his own talk show on CNBC. You can see him on 60 Minutes. Oh my god, he's written books, for god's sakes. And not only has he won an Emmy Award and a Golden Globe Award, but he was raised Orthodox Jewish, which is the most important thing to me, of course. And I'm talking about the wonderful Charles Grodinski, a.k.a. Charles Grodin, who is on the phone with us this fine morning. Shalom, Charles!
Oh, thank you, Rabbi. Actually, we just had that corrected. I was actually born Charles Grodin, but on Wikipedia it said Charles Grodinski, which is fine with me. But if I had been born Charles Grodinski, I would have probably kept the name.
Good for you. I was going to castigate you for changing your name.
No, I never did. In fact, my assistant recently, I asked her, would you change that because it's not accurate? No, it's way back when, maybe from in an area that I think is now called Belarus. It used to be called Brest-Litovsk, and between Russia and Poland, depending on what year that was and what war it was, way back when, the family name was Grodinski on my father's side, but my father's name was Grodin, and so I was born Grodin, and my brother was born Grodin, so there was never any name change on my part.
So it was your father coming through Ellis Island, or your grandfather?
My father was born in America. My mother was born in Brest-Litovsk, and she came with her mother and father, and my grandfather was a Talmudic scholar, actually.
Didn't she come from a long line of rabbis?
Well, he did, and so I assume that she did. But it was very much an Orthodox Jewish home, and with the candles and everything. But that was pretty much determined by my mother. My father was polite about it, but he did not choose to participate. I think he might have had a run-in with someone at the synagogue when his father passed away.
Oh.
And I don't know, I was too young to actually get to the heart of what was the problem, but he did come to see me be bar mitzvahed, and had an interesting background with my father. My father had a store in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, where he sold supplies to cleaners, tailors, and dressmakers. And I had started kindergarten at 4 and then Hebrew school at 7. So by the time I was bar mitzvahed at 13, I wanted to go on and play sports. I played different basketball, baseball, football, I even boxed at that time.
And
he wanted
of course,
me to come to work in the store.
Yes.
And I did, but not enough for his satisfaction. Because it wasn't a question of money. He could have afforded and did pay a young... you could pay a boy 50 cents an hour to do what I was doing. It was just the principle of it that bothered him, that I didn't come a sufficient amount of time, and he was very, very vocal about it. He was really determined and convinced that I was, to quote him, a lazy bum, so he was quite startled to see me graduate as the valedictorian. He also did come to Chicago, where I had a triple bar mitzvah, and because the rabbi wrote the speech and I was bar mitzvahed in 1948, the speech got applause because it was the founding of the State of Israel.
Oh, mitzvah, but wait a minute, what is a triple bar mitzvah?
There were three, my cousin and another boy, all were bar mitzvahed on the same Saturday.
Oh my, it must have gone on for 5.5 hours.
Well, you know how it is. And you know what, and you obviously know you're not allowed to applaud in a synagogue. And yet, because the rabbi had written such a brilliant speech, and it was really centered around the founding of the State of Israel, they actually applauded in the synagogue. So my father saw that, and he did live to see me graduate as a valedictorian, which he must have found rather baffling because he never saw me that way. And as a matter of fact, I it wasn't that I was such a dedicated student. It's just that I have an unusual retentive memory. So if someone says something to me about trigonometry or algebra or Latin, even though I may not understand anything you're saying, I can give it back on a test.
And in the old days, that's what teaching was. It was, I'll read this out, you remember it, we'll test you on it. And the whole idea of how you convey information in school now is kind of different.
Well, my favorite subject in high school was Hall Patrol. I had a very hard time sitting in an algebra, geometry, trigonometry, chemistry, or Latin class. I just did not know why those courses were being given. In fact, I think they should be optional, and we should spend more time teaching classes about human relations and how to get along with people and how to try to see yourself instead of just being judgmental of other people.
I think that's that is actually a lovely idea. Do you think that your persona was formed over well into your adult life of trying to please a father who was usually unpleasable?
Well, I don't really know. It's a very hard question for me to answer. I know that I was elected president in class all 4 years I was in high school. So this was all through this period that my father was not happy with me. But I do think that I remember once about the sixth time I had been elected. We had actually elections in those days every 6 months, oddly enough. And about the sixth time I had been elected by a wide margin, I asked what we used to call in those days one of the few Negro girls in the class.
Yes.
Her name was Joanne Snyder, and I asked her, Joanne, why is this happening? Because I really had no idea. It's not that I'm a modest person. I really had no idea why I was winning by such wide margins. And she said to me at the age of 16, you care about people. Well, as my mother would have said about me, it went in one ear and out the other, because I thought at the age of 16 that everybody cared about people, and it's only as years have gone by that I realize it's very rare.
Oh, of course.
That people care about other people.
When you're 16, you care about pimples. You care about learning how to maybe use a condom if you're lucky.
You know, it's just not, but I didn't realize that anything unusual was happening. And now, as time has gone by, because for the last 17 or 18 years or so, I've been an advocate for nonviolent inmates. And everyone assumes I'm an attorney because I've never failed to get anyone out of prison.
Well, did you do it with that guy? I know you're very big on that fellow who was sleeping when they
took Ryan Hawley in Florida.
Right.
Who no one, including the prosecutor, disputes, was home, asleep, in bed. He had lent his car to his roommate, as he had done many times before, and he went to sleep. The prosecutor doesn't dispute that he was home asleep in bed. He just simply said, no car, no murder. The roommate and others went out and committed a robbery and a murder, and they got sufficient, very harsh sentences, which is appropriate, in my opinion. But the boy who was home asleep in bed, and the conviction was for premeditated murder, which means you would have to believe that this young man who had no record, his mother works for an Air Force general, that he knew he was lending his car to be committed in a murder, which defies common sense. And I, who've been working, as I said, for all these years as an advocate, I've never even heard of a case like this.
And how's he? Is he out yet? Is he still in there?
No.
Oh, he's still.
And he will not get out unless people, because I'm reaching out everywhere. Bill O'Reilly, of all people, I was at a Kennedy event with him, and he asked me what I was doing, and I told him about Ryan Hawley in Florida, and he said if I got him the information, he would call Governor Scott, who's a Republican governor of Florida, and I'm told by Bill O'Reilly's producer, who's a Jewish fellow, by the way.
Oh, good.
That call is going to take place. I mean, it comes from an unlikely source, but you take it where you can get it. So I've reached out to many, many people, because it's very difficult. You know, people have the impression, many elected officials have the feeling, if they ever grant a clemency or a pardon or anything like that, it makes them look like they're soft on crime. And whenever I speak about this issue, when I'll appear at various places, I always begin my remarks by saying, I think we let too many people out of prison who shouldn't be let out of prison. Because if you're guilty of a violent crime, you are not going to be treated for it. If you're mentally ill or if you're drug addicted, this is not going to get taken care of in prison. So when you release these people, It's very. I wouldn't do it. That's why I say I've only gotten involved with people and the people who might have delivered a package. One of the cases that I got involved with in the 90s, a woman on welfare, a black woman in Harlem, a drug dealer gave her said, "I'll give you $2,500 if you deliver this package of cocaine to Albany." Well, she had four small children. Her son later told me we had like $5 to our name, and excuse me, she delivered this package and was arrested on the spot and sentenced to 20 years to life in prison. A mother of four small children on welfare. Of course, the family was destroyed, and by the time I was able to get her clemency from then-Governor Pataki of New York, she had served 17 years, and her youngest son was in prison. And about a year ago in January, I spoke at her oldest son. He was in his 30s. I spoke at his funeral. So the devastation that the system brought to this woman and to others, another very, very appealing one. These are first-time offenders with small children, all women. And this woman was, I got her clemency, and 2 years after she was released, she died of a heart attack, again, in her 30s. And I asked about how did that happen, and they said she never ate, she only smoked, she was very nervous.
Good Lord.
So we are, I always say the justice system is the biggest criminal we have in America because, as you know, we've not only executed people who later DNA showed were not guilty, but we lock people up for long periods of time for very minor nonviolent offenses, and that we represent 5% of the world's population and 25% of the world's prison population. And as I often say, this is not the America that I pledged allegiance to. When you start to read and hear about this stuff, and no country in the law, that law under which Ryan Hawley is serving a life sentence, that's called the felony murder rule. It means if you have anything to do with a felony, that would be, for example, a robbery that leads to a murder, you're as guilty as the person who committed
even
the
if murder. You're driving,
well, in this case, the boy was home asleep in bed. Now, no country in the world, every country that has this law, has gotten rid of it because of its unintended consequences. And the Canadian Supreme Court said it best when they said a person should be held responsible for their own actions, not the actions of others. Okay, I'm finished with that monologue.
Okay, no, it's very good and very fascinating. And I was also going to ask if you had read the Rolling Stone article a week or two ago about the whole third strike rule. There's a big thing about
it. Well, I have not read it, but I think it's, unless it's a very violent crime, I mean, at the time, I think they've just revamped the law, but I mean, you could shoplift a candy bar and go to prison for life if that was your third conviction.
Right, although
And that sounds like the Middle Ages to me.
Unless, of course, the second thing you did was a violent,
horrible crime.
Well,
then you shouldn't have been out in the first place, in my opinion.
There you go. That I definitely do agree with Charles Grodin on that. You are, I will say, so well-spoken, and I can see the reason that you had a talk show. No, seriously.
I'm a commentator now. I've been for the last 12 years for CBS Network News. And I do commentary, and I do it from home, and I have 2 million listeners every day across the country, and it's a great privilege.
Now, do you go through these things like I do when I'm doing my rabbinical reflections, my sermons, where 1 week you'll have 20 different things to talk about, you have so many, you figure you'll have material for a year, and then you go a couple of weeks, and then you're like, oh my God, what am I going to talk about today?
Well, you know, your sermons are longer. My commentaries I keep under a minute. As my wife says about me, I'm like a walking commentary. I mean, all I have to do is leave the house for 10 minutes, and I'll see something. It could be a bumper sticker. I haven't written this one yet, but it said, I don't believe, the bumper sticker said, I don't believe the liberal media. Well, the suggestion was this person believed the conservative media. Well, you shouldn't believe anything. You should double check and think 2, 3, 4 times for yourself, because nobody's 100% right, and people go on television and radio, and they hold forth like it's the gospel, but it is not.
Well, let's take the devil's advocate here for a moment. Not,
sure.
Not that a rabbi would be advocating for the devil, chas v'chalil, but if you were to, the better, is it not true, though, that the best commentators, for the sake of being watchable and entertaining, have to be, like there's a writer for the New York Post named Phil Mushnick. I don't know if you read him.
He's actually a good friend of mine.
I read him all the time. And
yeah, he's the first thing I read on Sundays because he writes about the world in general.
And right, that is true. And during the week, he writes about sports. And he's usually knocking on a particular sportscaster because the sportscaster is always giving these opinions that are like, this is absolutely, definitely so. And most of the time, he's wrong.
Mike Francesa.
Right. Mike Francesa. But doesn't it make Francesa more entertaining than him being like, well, I think this, and it could be this. But no, he goes, bum, ba, bum, ba, bum, and people listen. So,
I'm sure they do, because otherwise he wouldn't be on. He's on television as well. But I personally can't deal with that. I don't like people to be all-knowing, because no one is all-knowing. And I personally cannot relate to it. I have a hard time. I have to because I do what I do. I do watch the news and read the newspapers, but it's very difficult because they never run out of tragedies. And it's one after the other. And if I wasn't doing what I'm doing, I would be watching comedy, because it's too much. It's overwhelming. I mean, here we go with Korea again. I'm in touch with a Korean war veteran who was wounded in the war. And his wounds, of course, are getting worse. And now to think we're talking about a Korean war again. And, you know, I recently wrote that, you know, the leaders of North Korea don't realize that they will probably be killed. And more significantly, so will their children.
Well, I mean, if there is a real Korean War, this next one will last about 4.5 seconds.
Well, it shouldn't. Yes, that's exactly
boom,
right.
Boom, you know, and then...
The other thing that I've not liked recently, when they report about this Korean War, this missile threat, it's well into the report where anyone announces these missiles could not reach the United States. But in order to get the viewer's attention, they don't say that until well into the news report. I mean, it's still dangerous, of course, but if you're sitting on the West or East Coast, or on the West Coast particularly, you know, you would like to hear that first.
Of course, yeah. If you knew of Pearl Harbor or the coast of California, you're like, wait a minute.
Yeah. I mean, but too often I feel even the best broadcasts, they talk about things that are very alarming. There's a phrase in broadcasting: if it bleeds, it leads. And so much of it is like that. Now, I understand that, but after a certain point, I mean, you're just exhausted by it. It seems like it's just one threat after another, and unfortunately, it's true.
And it just, what does surprise me is that back in the days of the Cold War and the Cuban Missile Crisis and all that, we already thought that we had ways that we could bomb Russia from over here and they could bomb us from over there, and yet now Korea, with its nuclear weapons, we still don't think that it can get to the American mainland. You know, figure over 50 years they have improved missiles that they could pretty much go around the globe.
Well, it depends. I mean, some countries that would be true. I think it's true probably in the United States, but I don't think it would be true of Korea. And thankfully, it can't. I remember when they first, that's what, as you know, started our space program, when the Russians put Sputnik into outer space. And that started our space program. And I did a book recently where I was on the phone with two of our original astronauts. And one of them told me that when he was first called, he was from a test pilot school, and they explained to him what they were going to do. And he said to me, he got the impression it was like shooting a monkey out of a cannon at the circus. And he went back, and he had no interest in doing this. And his fellow flyer said to him, as he told me, he said, they said, don't you want to fly higher and faster than anyone else? And that's what made him become one of the original astronauts. It was either Wally Schirra, I forget which the other one it was. And I thought to myself, if someone asked me that question, don't you want to fly higher and faster than anyone ever has? The answer would be, no.
No, you're Jewish. You want a seatbelt?
No.
55 miles an hour on highway.
Lounger.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, 30 miles an hour in residential. It's fine.
Oh, really? The only time I'll go anywhere is as an advocate. I went and I spoke at the governor of Delaware's prayer breakfast a couple of years ago on behalf of a woman I was able to get out of prison who was a native of Delaware, where I'm friends with Ethel Kennedy, and she got me a meeting with Attorney General Holder about this felony murder rule. But I learned that he couldn't do anything about it because it's all controlled by each state. And three of our states, Kentucky, Michigan, and Hawaii, have gotten rid of it. But 47 of our states, including Los Angeles and Florida, where I'm working on two felony murder cases, they still, unfortunately, have it.
And you do all this kind of pro bono. This is your giving.
I don't get paid for anything. In the last 8 years, since I was working at 60 Minutes too as a commentator up until around 2003. In the last 8 years or so, I think I've worked for a fee. Off the top of my head, I think it might be two times, maybe three times. I've made in the last 8 years, maybe $50,000-$60,000 in 8 years. I do everything for charity, and I was having a conversation. I've recently become friendly with the New York Police Commissioner Ray Kelly, and we were talking at lunch, just the two of us, and he's just staring at me, and I said, "Why are you looking at me that way?" He says, "Aren't you aware that most people who people have heard of when they host these charity events, they're paid?" I said, I'm increasingly aware of it. I wouldn't even consider anything like that.
Actually, we're doing a fundraiser for Temple Sons of Bitches next month.
I see. I know you're very pro-Jewish. I understand that.
This would be. Are you? You're not.
I'm pro everything. I actually live life as though God is sitting on my shoulder. But the truth of the matter is, I'm an agnostic.
Oh, really? Wait a minute. How did you go? Wait a minute. You were raised Orthodox.
That's right.
And now you do not believe in the existence of any kind?
I believe in what I see in front of me. I'm on the board of a Catholic organization. I'm on the board of a Jewish organization. And I raise money for both. I raise money for one that's called Malta House. They provide housing for unwed mothers because I don't believe in abortion, personally, in my case.
I don't think you should ever have an abortion, Charles. I think if you get pregnant, you
don't intend to have one.
Right.
I would not participate in anything like that.
But at what point? I mean, you don't think even like the day after, boom, like not at all ever.
I'm only speaking for myself, Rabbi. I wouldn't tell anyone else how to feel.
Fair enough. That's
but
fair.
But for myself, I personally would. I would say at inception, I would not have anything to do with that.
Well, most women at inception wouldn't have anything to do with me either, so I know the feeling.
Oh, well.
Thank you so much.
Why are you in Colorado?
Why am I in Colorado? Because it's beautiful here, and we're painting the shul in Great Neck, and I didn't want the fumes to aggravate my prostate, so
do you live in Colorado?
Part of the time I do, yes.
And the rest of the time you live in Long Island?
Great Neck, New York. Beautiful Great Neck, New York.
I used to live at Amagansett.
Excuse me. Ooh, Amagansett. Whoa.
The reason I live in Connecticut is it took too long to get to Amagansett from New York City.
Right. Yeah, the railroad
takes... And that's why I live in Connecticut. But I also live in New York City. But in 5 years that we've had this apartment in New York City, I've still yet to stay there. I'm there, but I always want to come home to Connecticut.
Well, New York is just even.
Wife and son sometimes stay in New York.
I mean, even you're a very lucky man. You have wealth, you have fame, you have all that. For you, New York is like Woody Allen's New York. But even you realize that New York is crazy and insane and
well,
a place
you know,
to visit
it's
but
just
leave.
Too many people.
Yeah.
It's too crowded. I for 3 years I drove a cab in New York City. My first job when I came to New York City, I was a night watchman on the Brooklyn waterfront at Todd Shipyards. That's from midnight to 8. It was $1.62 an hour. If you did it during the day, it was $1 an hour. The cab paid about $3 an hour, and eventually I ended up working on the west side of Manhattan in the post office. And one day I showed a fellow working next to me that I was playing a leading role in a television show. And he said, we were stacking TV guides, and he said, he's got the same name you do. And I said, no, that is me. He said, well, if you're playing a lead in a television show, why are you working the post office? That one sentence caused me to quit. So for the next 10 years, I just pursued an acting career, and I made $3,000 a year for the first 10 years.
I guess television didn't pay. Live television.
There wasn't very
was
much
prestige.
Money. I was in a standing room only hit on Broadway when I was in my 20s. It starred Anthony Quinn, and my take home salary was $107 a week.
Well, I mean, $107 went a longer way back then, but still. And I'm sure Anthony Quinn and Ching Ching was making a little bit more than that.
Yeah, well, that's where that was appropriate. And when I asked for a raise, they laughed.
Well.
I never forgot it, and later when people began to hear of me and they sent me a script to do, I didn't even read it.
Or, I mean, the same people. The
producers. Yeah. I don't. I have a, what if, for better or worse. I'm an eye for an eye. That expression.
Well, see, there's still a little bit of Jew in you.
Oh, I very much believe in that. In fact, in my books, in my plays, in my screenplays, on things I'm working on right now, I will call people out by name, and only if they behave very badly. And inevitably, anyone who has behaved very badly toward me is famous for doing it with everyone.
Well, such as, since you'll name names, who are people that you have this grudge, legitimate grudge, against? What's an example?
Well, there was a man who passed away in the last couple of years named Elliot Kastner. He produced a movie I did in London in 1974 called 11 Harrow House. It had Sir John Gielgud, it had Trevor Howard, it had James Mason and Candace Bergen. And one day he asked me to have lunch with him at Pinewood Studios in London, and he just announced to me that the studio didn't like me. He wasn't suggesting I do anything differently. He just wanted them to know, he wanted me to know they didn't like me. He later told the studio privately that I took more time in makeup than Candace Bergen without telling them that Candace Bergen did her own makeup at home. Sometimes I don't use any makeup, and no one has ever been kept waiting for me. And when I got back to Hollywood and I spoke to the head of 20th Century Fox, Gordon Stuhlberg, about it, he used the expression, "You were Kastnerized." And I said, "What does that mean?" He says, whenever he thinks a picture's not going to be successful and he's the producer, he tries to make a fall guy out of somebody. And he did that. And I wrote about him in a number of books that I had published. And he told somebody I knew that if he ever saw me, he would kick me in the face. Unfortunately, my friend never asked him, did he ever say anything about you that wasn't true? So I will only go after people who are widely disliked. This man was actually, his obituary in the Times, his own son and former partner did not have the best things to say about him. And he's just one person, but there have been about a dozen.
A dozen?
Oh, yeah, I would say about a dozen. This is over a period of many, many years.
Still, so who's another? We all like here. Hearing a little bit of dirt and gossip. So.
Well, there was a very famous producer named Ray Stark.
Oh, yeah, well, yeah.
And he said to me, the first day I met him, he walked me to the door of his house. His wife was sitting 30 feet away in the living room, and he announced to me that he doesn't like to be photographed because he likes to cheat.
You mean on his...
I couldn't believe what he was saying.
Yeah.
And then I later, I'm not really as much involved in show business as you might think I am, but so I don't know a lot of these things, but I'm told he was widely despised by people.
But actually, that wasn't something nasty that he did to you. I mean, he announced this unfortunate thing.
I thought it was very, and he later did something very, I was doing a movie he was producing, and a woman that was my girlfriend at the time, I never saw anyone treated so badly as he treated her.
No, that's
and
not.
I spoke out about him when they asked to interview me for People magazine. And then he countered. He got a substitute columnist for the famous columnist in New York, Earl Wilson, somebody named Tim Boxer. He got him into print an item about me, a nasty item about me, which wasn't true.
Uh-oh. Well.
So I have a very long memory. And I also remember, I'm sorry to say this, but when I was in Hebrew school, I was actually kicked out of Hebrew school because I dared ask the rabbi what the Hebrew words meant that we were reciting on the blackboard. In fairness to the rabbi, I may have asked more than once. I was impeached as president of my fifth grade class when I was 10 years old.
Wait a minute. What? How? What? You were impeached?
I was removed from the presidency at the age of 10 because I dared ask the teacher what I thought was a legitimate question, which is, why do we have to walk single file, no talking, since all the classes are changing at the same time? I have been kicked out of a number of things, but I always, looking back, economics class in high school, I would ask for a further explanation of the economic theory. I was an A student, and I thought the others were either too shy or not interested enough. That I was sincere in my questions, including what do the Hebrew word. I was never a wise guy. And then when I came to New York and studied acting with the famous teacher Uta Hagen, she had us carrying imaginary suitcases and opening imaginary windows. And I asked, in all sincerity, I asked her what the purpose of that was. Well, she despised me.
Oh, boy.
And openly was open about sitting next to someone I know, and she looked up at me, and she said, he came into my class and acted as though he knew everything. And I said, I'm very sorry if I gave that impression, because I didn't know anything. I was just trying to understand what was happening. And she reached up, took my hand, and kissed it.
All right, well, that's a little bit of... she probably saw a chorus line. I'll bet that's what changed things. She saw that the song Nothing about Mr. Karp and the idiotic exercises. And she said, you know what? That Groton guy, he may have had a point. But you also, did you study with Lee Strasberg as well?
Lee Strasberg for 3 years. That was after 3 years with Uta Hagge, and that was after some time at the University of Miami in Florida, and after some time at the Pittsburgh Playhouse. And Lee Strasberg, too, he would get you up there to take an imaginary shower. By that time, I had been so despised by Uta Hagge, and I chose not to ask what the purpose of an imaginary shower was. I just didn't take one and hoped he wouldn't notice. He also had everyone on class, and they do this to this day, get up on stage, sit in a chair, and try to fall asleep in a chair as a relaxation exercise, which is not a good idea. If you're about to go on stage or on camera, you don't want to fall asleep in a chair. Your mind might wander to nervous thought. What you want to do is focus as strongly as you can on what you're supposed to be doing. But I, of course, didn't say anything. I'd had so much trouble by that time. But one day, someone was doing a class, and the people would be brilliant. There was not a dearth of talent.
Right.
But what you had in show business, actually, I have a Applause Books has a DVD out by me now called, it's called The Perils of Show Business. And its basic message is about 3% of the people who go into this field make a living, and maybe 1% would you have ever heard of anyone. And it's not necessarily the ones that who are the most gifted, but it's the ones who could have the thickest skin and who persevere the most. But one day in class, as Lee Strasberg was talking for 30 minutes about a scene which looked quite brilliant to me, he glanced over toward me and he just casually said, do what he does. And that was it. And that was a big confidence builder for me, although frankly I didn't lack confidence. I knew I didn't know what I was doing, but I knew if I just stuck with it long enough, possibly I'd be able to figure it out. But the key is, are you willing to make almost no money and stay with it? And you still may not ever make a living, because unfortunately, as is true in just about every profession, the people in positions of judgment don't necessarily know what they're doing. Look at the people that got us into the war in Iraq.
Oh, maybe they did know exactly what they were doing.
I hope not. That would make them evil, but they were uninformed.
Okay, well, yeah, but we'll give them the benefit of a doubt on that. But I'm wondering what you, specific things that you did learn from taking all those classes at the university.
The most valuable thing I learned was I got so used, that's just 8 years of studying, I got very, very used to being up in front of people.
Mm.
That was the big benefit. As far as learning what they were saying, and I read every book on acting as well, you really had to figure it out for yourself. And the basic thing that you do learn is you have to, when you're acting, you have to do, it has to be exactly the same as when you're not acting. You have to listen to what the other person is saying so you'll know how to respond. The other thing that I noticed over the years is the only two people I ever worked with were Robert De Niro and Ellen Burstyn, who believed, as I do, how important it is that you know your lines the way you could count to 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. You cannot be thinking about your words. Otherwise, you can't concentrate on what the other person is saying, and then it can't affect you. And that's what happens. I've been doing it so long that even today, if I would just stand up in front of my wife and, like in the Beethoven movies, and just say, I want to know where my dog is, tears will rush to my eyes. It's like I'm so raw from it all already, and it doesn't hurt that I'm an advocate, which keeps you pretty vulnerable all the time.
And a Jew and a Democrat. All of those things kind of roll up.
Well, I'm former Jew. I have positions that are considered conservative. For example, no one can explain to me the reasons for the estate tax. That's a Republican position. I don't understand double taxation. The answer given to me by my friend Jonathan Alder, who's an intellectual, a liberal intellectual, he says people, they didn't want to see money kept in one family over a period of generations. Well, whether you're the Vanderbilts or the Rockefellers, I don't believe in that. I believe if you pay taxes on it, there shouldn't be a double taxation. And so when it comes to my closest friends, oddly enough, in the political world are Republican. And I remember there's a retired state senator in New York named Dale Volcker. And I went to Albany a great distance for his birthday party. And he made a speech, and he said, well, first of all, people were shocked to see me there because they make an assumption about me.
Right.
And he said, Charles Grodin has a kind heart, and he kind of handed it to me. And what I have found is as far as in Washington, my closest relationship is with Orrin Hatch, who I met through the Kennedys. So it with me, you'd have to say, what's the question? And then I would tell you what I thought, and I don't know whether that's going to be a conservative or a liberal point of view, because it would depend on what the question was.
Well, that's how we all should be.
Well, that's what I believe. That's what I believe. I mean, I would be for same-sex marriage, because I believe these people who are gay should be entitled to the same rights.
Absolutely true. Yes.
Right now, if it's not called marriage, you can't visit your partner in a intensive care unit, for example. And there's financial ramifications as well. So I really would have to hear the question before I would know what I would say.
Now,
I do have many opinions, but they're not always what people would assume they are.
Now, can I ask, moving off to getting back to education thing, did you ever get a college degree?
No, I had a very hard time. Even though I was the valedictorian, my favorite subject was Hall Patrol.
Well,
I had a very difficult time sitting in those classes. I remember going to the University of Miami, and in the class I most remember was semantics. I don't see the reason for it. I don't see the reason to study Latin, algebra, geometry, trigonometry. In fact, I remember when I was in ninth grade in high school, the teacher came along, and it was though you were in a casino. You were playing casino, and he put your report card face down on your desk, so you have to. And I thought, well, this is the first time I'm going to, you know, I was an A or B student, and I thought, well, now I'm going to fail because I don't understand anything. And I looked up at my report card, and it was an A, and that's the first time I learned about grading on the curve, because compared to me, the others had passed out in the aisles already.
Well, the curving and all that, but so you don't regret not having that?
I've been a student my whole life. I've read a lot of things. I married a former critic for the Times of London who went to Dartmouth.
Oh.
And I study. I've done a lot of reading and studying over the years, and I don't regret it, because too much of what I was being asked to do, I didn't understand the reason for it.
Well, that's most of life, isn't it?
Yes, I don't understand it, and I just try to do the best I can. And I have three themes I'd like to share with you that run through my, they're like a mantra with all of my commentaries. The first one is err on the side of caution. You will not hear about me falling off a mountain, because I'm not going to climb a mountain.
This is good, yes.
The second one is the best way to help yourself is to help others.
That's nice, I like
that. In my experience. And the third one is, since I have two friends locally, who one lost their only daughter, the other lost his only son in accidents, I then say whenever anything negative happens to me, and I've told them this too, I ask myself, compared to what?
Well, that's, yeah. I mean, or the old thing, it could always be worse. The man with...
Well, that's right, you know.
With losing an arm, there's another guy who lost two arms.
Well, you know, I mean, a boy came home, this is about 3 years ago, he was on leave from Iraq, he was going to be sent to Afghanistan, there was alcohol involved, and he was killed in a car crash in Westport, Connecticut. And it was the only son of this man who I didn't know the family. I went to the wake, and I saw the three sisters, the younger sisters, sobbing uncontrollably by the open casket. And then I became friends with the family, and I not because I could be solaced, but I thought being in the movies I could possibly be a distraction. Because if you have somebody you've seen in the movie sitting at your dinner table, It's distracting.
Okay. It's nice that you admit that. It's sort of nice that you have a celebrity who says, I understand I'm a celebrity. There's something, because I'm sure you have sat at dinner tables with people where you went, even though, you know, you've worked with famous people and you're famous yourself.
You know, what's odd about it, in 1962, when Anthony Quinn was the star of the play where I had a featured role, to me, he was this actor in the play. But one day outside the theater, I saw him walking toward the theater, crossing the street, and I thought to myself, look, there's Anthony Quinn. When I was in the theater working with him, he was the actor playing the role. I don't know why that is. It's very fortunate. I don't deal with nerves. In fact, when I appear, I'm probably at my most relaxed because I'm appearing. It's actually my birthday at this Suffolk Theater in Long Island, and they just asked if I would come out there. And I said, as long as you can get me there, because I'm directionally challenged. I have what's called directional dyslexia. I can get lost very easily. So I'm going to go out there because this theater, I don't even know the background, but they asked me, and it's a line I wrote in a movie I wrote once, and it's a line I try to apply to life itself, which is, I always try very hard to say yes because everyone else so easily says no.
That's very sweet. And by the way, from what I've heard about this theater, the Suffolk Theater in Riverhead, New York, where Charles Grodin will be appearing tomorrow, Sunday, April 21st at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, the theater is refurbished. It had sat as an empty, dead, old movie theater for years and years and years.
I didn't know about that, but I do want to say, because we're having a on the serious side our conversation, this is going to be an afternoon of comedy. I do comedy, and I'll show comedy film clips with Johnny Carson, me and Jay Leno, and David Letterman, and things like that. So it's going to be an hour of comedy, because I will do this. I mean, you're a rabbi. I went to Hebrew school. All right, I was thrown out, but I was eventually bar mitzvahed. But so we're having a proper serious conversation. But at the Suffolk Theater, it will be all comedy.
That's it. Well, you can throw in like 90 seconds of social justice.
Maybe
60 minutes of comedy, 1.5 minutes of social justice. The audience will love you.
Now, are you going to be in Colorado, or are you going to be at this theater?
I wish I could be there at the. No, I'm not coming back to New York for 2 more weeks, unfortunately.
Now, you're not wanted by the authorities, are you, Rabbi?
Well, I'm actually. I believe it or not, the rabbi does his own one-man show, so I come with that to New York.
Rabbi, I'm not even remotely surprised. I went. There's a rabbi called Shmuley Hecht. He's at Yale, and he invited me up to speak on the justice system. So I went up with some Jewish society at Yale, and I've been talking about the felony murder law. It's about 2 minutes into my speech, and Rabbi Hecht began to speak, and I thought he was going to ask me a question. He spoke for the next 40 minutes.
That's a Jew for yes, absolutely.
And I just stood there and said, oh, this is unique, because I don't really, even Yale is traveling for me.
Well, you know, I actually bring a digital rim shot when I do my sermons, just in case.
Well, that's important.
Yeah, it really is. Do you have a couple more minutes so I can ask you some more about
anything people? You'd like, of course.
Oh, wonderful. Okay, I don't want to, take up
too
much.
No, I'll tell you, I have to be at 1 o'clock. I'm hosting a brunch to benefit Hungerthon, World Hunger.
Oh, my God. Was that the thing that they started years and years ago with
Bill Ayers?
Pete Wingatel and all those folks. Yeah. Well, the late Pete.
And I've been somebody that's been auctioned off every year.
I beg your pardon?
And it seems like the same person always buys me. And she doesn't buy me because she was interested in me. She buys me because she knows I probably, and I will today, have my friend Regis Philbin sitting at the table. That's how she gets to see Regis Philbin.
Oh, Regis. Beloved
Regis. So there's not, I was kidding with him yesterday on the phone. I said, she won't even look at me.
Well, you're 2 degrees of separation from Regis
Philbin. That's it. That's what it is. That's exactly right.
So let me ask some of the people that you have worked with in Hollywood. You told some unhappy, nasty stories before. Maybe these will be happy stories, which are just as nice to hear.
Sure.
So, for example, a person that you've worked with several times is Elaine May, playwright
director. Well, she's my benefactor. Elaine May. I met her through Renee Taylor and Joe Bologna, who wrote a play called Lovers and Other Strangers.
Sure.
That I directed on Broadway, and that's how I met her. And then at some point, I was directing Renee and Joe in something for PBS, and Joe had been a director of commercials. commercials. And in the first day of rehearsal, I said, you know, you should actually be directing this, and I should be playing that part. And he said, well, we did base the role on you. And I climbed into bed. Elaine May saw it, and then she told me that she's being asked to direct movies. And the first time, she's going to deliberately find one to star me in, and that was The Heartbreak Kid.
Right.
There were a lot of very big-name actors, and I was unknown at the time. And so she has been a real benefactor. In fact, I'm doing a reading of a play that my last play that was done in New York was called The Right Kind of People. It was about a Fifth Avenue co-op board that I served on. And we're doing a reading of it because it's possibly going to be revived at a bigger theater.
Ooh.
And the producer involved with me told me that she will come in and read one of the roles. So
you mean Elaine May
dedicated
will come
to me, and I've been dedicated to her.
That is so great. And you know, through thick and through thin, I mean, we don't have to bring up the movie. I am bringing up the movie Ishtar, which is better than people thought it was.
You know, what's interesting about this, my daughter is a headlining stand-up comedian. And I don't think the problem with Ishtar is people don't realize that if you go to open mic night, which means that anyone can get up, you will see people very similar to what Dustin and Warren played in that movie.
Oh, absolutely. So
it's
yeah.
not this far-fetched story because they didn't, I think it was too hip for the room, because when they're making up these songs, a cup of coffee, half a cup of coffee, boy, when you're hot, you're hot. They don't understand that there are people all over the place of that level of talent who are very excited about their talent.
People like me, as a matter of fact.
And that's in fact, I remember one line. I'm sitting in there on stage, you know, just being terrible. We shot this in Morocco, in Marrakesh, and I'm sitting with somebody from a record executive. I was a CIA agent, and without even looking at them as they're performing, I just look at the stage. I say, "That's the single."
Now, also, you have worked, speaking of brilliant women, with Lily Tomlin. I did not remember this from the incredible Shrinking Woman.
Oh, yeah, I'm very, very fond of her. Had an interesting story with her. This was in the incredible Shrinking Woman, and what was unusual about the movie was that the amount of time that Lily and all of us were being, in other words, we could be called for 8 a.m., and we might go to work at 4 in the afternoon. Well, that's not a good thing. Whenever I've directed, I'm very cognizant of when the actor... You don't want to keep someone sitting and waiting for several hours.
Right.
You want to do that as little as possible. And I remember, and I didn't want to approach a director I didn't want to just speak for myself. I wanted to be sure I was speaking for everyone. So I asked the different members of the cast, and I asked one young woman, and she actually believed that I had to disabuse her of this notion. She actually believed that the director was intentionally trying to give her a nervous breakdown by keeping her. And I said, honey, this is not happening. But I went to the director. It was his first directing job. And I think with all the special effects of the Shrinking Woman, it was overwhelming him.
Yeah.
And I went to him and I said, would you consider giving some thought to the actor's calls? And he looked at me like I was out of my mind. He said, you expect me to think about that? And then he said to me, you're like a Jewish prince. Then he must have seen something in my eye, which can happen. And he quickly said, and I'm white trash.
Nice correction, though. Nice.
But he did not. He couldn't handle it. In fairness to him, I've directed on Broadway, television specials, off-Broadway, wherever, but I have never wanted to direct a movie because you can see the director age right in front of your eyes.
I mean, it's just so much to... I mean, if the sun goes
so
behind a cloud...
And there's so many people whispering, and I'm friends with Barry Levinson, who's a very famous film director.
Yes.
And I asked him, what did he think about it? He says, there's just too many people whispering in your ear all the time. I recently saw... I was just watching Flipping Channels in a... I can't watch these shows, American Idol or America's Got Talent or Dancing, but those kind of
right.
where there's a panel of judges, because I've spent my life being judged. And I saw this woman, and she was just wonderful. She had a backup group. I thought she was spectacular, and I didn't even I just was watching her. I didn't even realize what I was watching. Then they went to the panel, and on the panel was this wonderful singer, Mariah Carey. And she starts to give her notes, and I quickly flip the channel, because people are always ready to give you notes, but maybe there. I remember going out of town in this play I did with Anthony Quinn. It's funny this comes up now because I just, for some reason, maybe because I'm working on a number of books, and I was on a train going for the out of town to try out to New Haven or Boston or wherever, and a young actor came over. There were two silent. There was a woman who played a lot of silent roles, and a man who played a lot of silent roles, and there were only three speaking roles: Anthony Quinn, Margaret Leighton, and I in the cast. And the fellow sat down next to me on the train. He says, "Would you like to hear what I think about what you're doing?" And I said, "No, thank you."
Hmm.
Because it can be very destructive, and it can get into your mind.
Would you read reviews?
Pretty often it's not accurate at all.
When you were acting and directing, I mean, more so on, you know, on and off Broadway, and would you read reviews while the show was still going, or would you wait until the closing day and then...
I generally don't read reviews. I generally like to know, you know, how are we doing. But I don't really read reviews. I'll tell you one story about it. I was once on a panel discussion on the radio, and with a group of critics, and I made the point that I would be just as interested in the opinion of a friend of mine as I would in a critic, and no one thought that was such an earth-shattering thing to say, except one critic. She was clearly offended, and when I opened in same time next year, 1975, with Ellen Burstyn, a two-character show. It was a huge hit. It was standing room only. And out of 35 reviews, she was the only one to criticize me.
Hmm.
So it can get so personal.
That wasn't Edith Oliver, was it?
No, it was not.
Okay, just check.
It can get very, very personal. In fact, in 1974, a critic who I think was reached by this Elliot Kastner character, he gave a blistering review of this movie, 11 Harrow House, which I wrote as well as played the leading role in. And his last line of the review was, "It would be sad to think an acting career lay ahead." And the next year, I won a Best Actor Award on Broadway. So I'm not. I pretty much go with what I believe. And one of the key things is, people underestimate how hard you have to work, and they underestimate how you must persevere, because too often people are there who really don't know what they're talking about.
You know, I have to wrap this up, and yet I have so many more questions. One more question. Please forgive me for taking your time. But I had also not remembered that you were in the film Real Life with the director Albert Brooks.
Yeah, I thought that was a very, very good movie.
And it presaged the whole idea of
reality television.
Yeah. What was Brooks like working on it? He had done short films for Saturday Night Live.
Well, his short films is how I knew him when he was working for Saturday Night Live. He did a memorable short film. He did a number of them, but I'll tell you the one that I think you might enjoy, or your audience might enjoy the most. He had, as though you were watching C-SPAN, it was the State of Israel going to trade geographical places with the state of Georgia. And everybody was there, and it was like you were really looking at this thing, and the representative of the state of Israel stood up and he says, "I only hope we get along better with our friends in Mississippi than we do with our friends in Egypt." And I was an Albert Brooks sucker from that. In fact, recently I was watching him in a movie called The Scout, where he's very, very funny, very, very gifted.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But do you have any memories of working with him on his first full-length film? You know, his method, what he did, any anecdotes?
I have one anecdote, and it doesn't favor him, but it's true.
Okay.
There's a scene in the movie where, because of all the cameras around, with the Etnauers, they're called, where the cameramen are wearing the cameras on their head.
Right, yes.
And there's so many cameras around that I give, and I'm playing an animal doctor is called a what?
A veterinarian.
Veterinarian, right.
Yeah.
And I get, because I'm so distracted, I give anesthesia to the horse twice, and the horse dies on the table. And the question he asked me at the time was, "Where do you think we should shoot the next scene?" Which would be me asking him to please don't include that in the documentary that he's making within the movie, because I've never killed an animal that size, and it certainly is going to hurt my practice. He said, "Where did I think we should shoot it?" Because I had directed a lot, and he asked me. I said, "Well, I think in my office, you know." And so we shot the scene in my office, and I made my case. "I'd really appreciate it if you wouldn't use that in the movie." And the next day, he just apparently to him, he didn't like the scene that was placed in my office. I didn't see anything wrong with it at all. And that one blow up at me was all I needed. And because in years, I think he's a brilliant talent, but I've since been asked to give him an award, and I declined, and I'm sure he has no reason, no understanding of why that is. But you don't get to yell at me.
Oh, my God. Wow. Well,
but that doesn't take away from his brilliant talent. As a matter of fact, the first time I met Mel Brooks, he started to yell at me. I was with Gene Wilder, and at that time I was the screenwriter of the movie version of Woody Allen's play, Play It Again, Sam, and they had chosen the director Herb Ross to direct it. And I met Mel Brooks, and he started to scream at me because he was angry that he wasn't asked to direct it. And why was Herb Ross? Well, I had no authority of that kind of authority at all. It was Woody Allen ended up writing the shooting script. It wasn't even me.
Right, yeah.
But he just started to yell at me. And a friend of mine at HBO told me the first time she talked to him, he yelled at her too. So I don't, that's unforgivable. I just don't believe in anything like that. And I don't tolerate it, frankly. And I will name them. And I believe in, even if you, if things are happening in your own area and people are behaving badly, say at a certain store, rest, whatever, I believe in making it known.
Wow, maybe that's the way Mel Brooks says hello.
Well, that's a very generous company, but he too is very obviously very gifted.
So, Charles Grodin, what is your most cherished memory in all your work and all your years, Broadway, film, television? Don't do a social justice thing. Let's do like a Starry sort of thing.
Well, I have to tell you, when I go to sleep at night and I try to feel good, it is about getting people out of prison who shouldn't have been in.
I knew it would come there, but yeah, that is a wonderful thing. That is,
and
yeah.
As far if you're asking a show business story, that's a harder one. I really don't know. I mean, they've all been generally very good. I've always gotten along very well with people, and these people that I'm calling out, they are the exceptions. Generally speaking, people are very nice to me, very nice to me, and I have made a lot of friends in show business, and my closest male friend today is somebody I did my first movie with in 1964, and we've been friends since 1964, and we've never even had a bumpy moment. His name is John Gabriel, and if there's any women's groups out there listening, Google John Gabriel. He's a natural, and he's brilliant, and he will sing the standards and make you understand what the songs really mean.
Hmm. Well, I'm not sure why you mentioned the women's group. What did I miss there?
Well, that's where he would be singing.
Oh.
The women's groups, if you want to have a singer and you don't want to pay for Tony Bennett.
Oh, I see what you're... Okay, sure. I wouldn't mind singing
Gabriel
in front of a women's group.
He's masterful, and he's the dearest person... he's as dear a human being as I've ever met.
Well, you have been quite dear, and surprisingly so, considering, you know, some of the reputation you have on talk shows and things like that.
You know, for people that don't know, that's an act. I stopped doing it. I upset David Letterman because I said I can't come on anymore because being an advocate, you know, I'll talk to people in the media or I'll talk to a senator or a governor, and you can feel the nervousness. Because they don't know I'm just kidding around when I'm out there.
Well,
I just did that. I didn't have the confidence when I went first on Johnny Carson in 1973 to go out there and say, well, if anything happened, I just didn't. So I had to immediately become a contrarian. So if he would say, how are you? I would say, I really can't answer that question because you have no interest in how I am. And he says, well, that's true. And,
but
I actually ended up under contract to him as a guest.
Well, but also, I guess they all knew. Letterman knew and Carson.
Well, the host knows.
Yeah.
A lot of the viewers don't know.
Right. I mean, when we used to watch Brother Theodore on David Letterman, and it was as if Letterman didn't realize what he was getting in. Of course, he knew Theodore's. You know who Brother Theodore was.
No, right? I don't know who that is.
Oh, my God. He was a Holocaust survivor, lost most of his family, and ended up. Just look up Brother Theodore. That was the.
Brother Theodore, I will.
He did an off Broadway one person show at the 13th Street Theater for many, many. He became a cult figure.
Oh, it sounds interesting. I'm going to ask my wife to do it whenever she's got the computer. I don't even have a fax machine. That's as far as I'll go.
It's really dark, brilliant humor. You kind of...
Theodore. Well, I'd be interested in seeing that.
And let me tell you, he comes through best via fax. just so you know. So if you fax his image, that'll be funnier than anything he ever did. No,
if you fax his image, what does that mean?
I'm just doing bad comedy here. I tried, I failed.
Oh, I
thank you for pointing that out, Charles.
I see. I didn't quite get that, but look, you know.
Everybody, go, please, go see.
That's not Jewish humor, is it? That fax thing?
There's the X in there, so that kind of makes it Christian.
Oh, you're okay.
That's why I failed. I was trying to do Christian humor.
Oh, my Lord.
Blew it terribly. Charles Grodin is going to be at the Suffolk Theater in Riverhead. For tickets, call 631-727-4343. 631-727-4343. It's tomorrow afternoon. You can also find information at suffolktheater.com, and that's theater with an E-R. Charles Grodin, I can only wish you more books, more television, more movies, more fun, good luck in the revival of the play that they're going to do. Everything good should happen to you, and maybe you should find a little bit of God again. I know you're an agnostic, but
Rabbi Saul, you radiate goodness. I mean that.
That's just my odor. I haven't showered yet, but thank you.
Oh, well, you'll take a shower, then we'll talk.
Then we'll talk. Charles Grodin, bless you, and thank you for being in the neighborhood.
Thank you, Rabbi. This is Charles Grodin. I had a wonderful time talking to Rabbi Saul on Dave's Gone By on UNC Radio.